Blevins Hinkle, Director of Spirit and Place. On behalf of our Community Advisory Board, the Polis Center, which manages the Spirit and Place Festival on behalf of its community partners, and our parent unit, the IU School of Liberal Arts at IUPUI, I welcome you to the 12th Annual Public Conversation, the signature event of the Spirit and Place Festival. Since 1996, Spirit and Place has illuminated where we've been, who we are today, and what we want to become. It's a festival where the arts, religion, and humanities collaborate to foster civic engagement, respect for diversity, and public imagination. This year, over 150 community organizations will partner to present 71 festival events, films and documentaries, workshops and worship services, performances and plays, storytelling, poetry readings, and more. This unique enterprise is made possible by the vision and support of countless people and organizations, including our 2007 theme partners, the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University and the Central Indiana Community Foundation, along with our major financial partners, Lilly Endowment, the Indianapolis Foundation, an affiliate of the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Alan Whitehill Clues Charitable Foundation, Butler University, IUPUI, and the University of Indianapolis. Would you please join me in thanking these organizations as well as our many other contributors and partners? The collaboration embodied by these organizations allows us to stage today's public conversation, which will explore what it means to live generously. When the conversation concludes, we ask you to take a moment and complete the evaluation form that you'll find in your program. If you turn in your completed and signed program at the end of the presentation today, you'll be eligible to win a set of signed books, CDs, and DVDs from our guests today. But you got to turn it in signed. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Eugene Temple, Executive Director of the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University. For each of the past 10 years, the Nonprofit Times has named Dr. Temple one of the nonprofit sector's 50 most influential leaders, a distinction held by only four people in the nation. Under his leadership, the Center on Philanthropy has become a world leader in the study and practice of philanthropy. Please welcome Gene Temple.
Thank you very much, Pam. My standard line in response to anything anyone says about me is, I remember I grew up on a farm in southern Indiana. The Center on Philanthropy is pleased to be partnering with Spirit and Place this year for this particular festival. We're grateful for the space that Spirit and Place provides this community to discuss important issues of a variety. The Center has been pleased to be involved in many of the Spirit and Place festivals in the past, but we're especially pleased to be partner on the occasion of our 20th anniversary and to be a partner around the theme, Living Generously, because living generously is what the Center's work is all about, helping donors, nonprofits, and communities meet needs and find fulfillment by living generously. We do this in Indianapolis, across the country, and around the globe, through research, especially research on giving and volunteering, through our academic degree programs, especially the Master of Arts and the PhD in Philanthropic Studies, through, by providing resources for donors, wealth managers, and donor advisors, by providing training and best practice information for nonprofit executives, fundraisers, volunteers, and others, and by creating congregational cultures of generosity through the Lake Family Institute on Faith and Giving. Generosity is a relative term. It's the measure of how people give and how communities care for each other relative to the resources they have available. It's about how people give, not just about how much people give. I want to thank Patty, Bernice, and Nathan for helping us understand what a generous life looks like through the three perspectives they'll share this afternoon. And I want to thank you, the audience, for being here to initiate this important discussion. It's now my pleasure to introduce Scott Russell Sanders. Scott is in his sixth year as a moderator for this particular conversation. He's a distinguished professor of English at Indiana University and one of Indiana's leading literary voices. Please join me in welcoming Scott Sanders.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. We come together this afternoon, as we do throughout the festival, to practice being citizens and neighbors, because we believe in the power of genuine dialogue to help us learn from one another, help us address the problems we face in common, and help us live more responsibly and wisely. This year's theme may seem deceptively simple. After all, the world's religions urge us to live generously, to care for the needy, to relieve suffering, to treat others as we wish to be treated. These sentiments are echoed in many works of art, in uplifting speeches, and in the advice most parents give to their children. Yet how do we care for our neighbors when the neighborhood stretches around the globe? When the electronic media bring to our attention the crushing needs of several billion human beings? How do we treat others compassionately if we have been mistreated? How do we live generously if we are working two jobs or barely making ends meet? How do we share what we have if we are afraid there won't be enough to go around? Enough jobs, food, water, land. How do we overcome selfishness in the face of a commercial culture that urges us to care only about our own appetites, appearance, and comfort? Here to help us reflect on such questions are three distinguished guests. You will find their brief biographies in your festival program. Let me add a few additional notes while asking you to hold your applause until I have introduced all three. Bernice Johnson Regan, to my right, began life in Georgia as the daughter of a Baptist minister, surrounded by sacred music, and she came of age during the civil rights movement. For demonstrating on campus, she was expelled from Albany State College and locked up in the local jail. No doubt officials at Albany State bitterly regret that expulsion, because Ms. Regan went on to complete her degree at Spelman College, then to earn a PhD in history at Howard University, and then to receive thus far 14 honorary degrees from the likes of Princeton, Boston College, and the University of Michigan. Those academic honors are only one measure of her distinction as composer, scholar, and performer. Through her books and recordings, her work for television and film, her service as a curator at the Smithsonian Institution, and her concerts worldwide, she has inspired a deeper appreciation for African American history and culture, for human history and culture. At the heart of this great tradition is a sense of community and solidarity, an exuberant creativity, and a generosity of soul, all qualities richly embodied in our honored guest. Patty Stonecipher was born and bred in Indianapolis, where she learned about urgent human needs, from hunger and homelessness to struggling schools. Here in her hometown, she also witnessed abundant examples of generous living, beginning with her own family, and including churches, public agencies, charitable foundations, and countless individuals. She observed, for example, her father running a soup kitchen with support from the Lilly Endowment. After graduating from Indiana University, she worked in Indianapolis as an editor of computer books and then was hired away from our neighborhood by Microsoft. She soon rose to the top of the firm's interactive media division, where she helped launch the MSNBC network and Encarta Online. Within a decade, she had accomplished enough to retire from this strenuous life, or so she thought, until Bill Gates persuaded her to take over leadership of the Gates Foundation. She now oversees the distribution of more than $1 billion in grants each year. Grants aimed at promoting equity and relieving suffering, especially through the delivery of health care and quality education to the world's poor. The neighborhood she serves now stretches around the planet. Nathan Dungan credits his parents as being the chief inspiration for the work he does today. With a mother who was a pioneer in financial services and a father who was a Lutheran minister and addiction counselor, he was ideally prepared to diagnose the obsessive materialism and consumerism that afflict so many Americans today. While working as a financial advisor, he began reaching out beyond his client base to offer community workshops aimed at helping adults and young people reconcile their money habits with their values. Moved by this experience, he set out to educate a broader audience about the ethical issues surrounding the pursuit and use of money. In 2003, he founded Share, Save, Spend, an organization that in its very title places generosity first, prudence second, and serving one's own needs third. Through his writings, lectures and workshops, through radio and television appearances, and most recently through a program made for the public broadcasting system, Mr. Dungan has become one of America's foremost guides to achieving financial sanity and practicing stewardship. Please join me in welcoming our guests. Once again this year, we have asked two community leaders to raise questions from the audience. Later on in our conversation, you will hear questions from Judith Sebula, Director of the Center for Faith and Vocation at Butler University, and from Jane Hinniger, Director of Project Citizen, a program of the Indiana Bar Foundation. So to begin, let me ask each of you, really, I hope will answer, about examples of generous living that influenced you, that have had a powerful effect on your life.
I think about the life of Ella Josephine Baker, who for more than half a century was an organizer in this country. During the Depression in Harlem, she organized collectives so people could buy milk and other essential foodstuff to survive the Depression. During the 40s, she was head of the membership campaign for the NAACP, and the membership for the first time went over 1 million members. During the Montgomery bus boycott, she was acting executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, mostly because she was a woman and they were not going to put a woman in as executive director. She also was not a minister. And after that, and it's when I met her, she was an advisor for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, probably because she was too old to be considered in our generation. And I am challenged even today at the examples she gave in her life She usually had a job that paid a salary, but my sense is that she was always doing the same work everywhere, organizing to help people to understand that they had the power to get together and actually name their issues and map out strategies to change the conditions under which they had to exist.
All right. Go ahead.
Well, you touched on it in your introduction, which is that I would use as my first example my parents. I'm one of nine kids. I was raised on the corner, 43rd and Central, a couple of miles from here at the most. And, you know, my dad was a salesman. He sold cars. He sold phones. He sold a whole range of things. But what I saw him as and what I saw my mom as, besides the people who made us behave in a very strict way with such a big family, was people who were always looking to see the gap between their values, which is that all lives have equal value, and the reality, whether it was the people next door that needed something or the family in the parish that needed something or the soup kitchen or the food pantry that needed more support or the St. Vincent de Paul. And that presumption that there was a set of values held in that household and a set of realities and the need to activate what resources you had, whether that was money, and that it often wasn't money, it often was time, energy, or voice, which I think we all use too little to speak out against the gap between what we believe and what we see. Those were things that from the very beginning of life I saw acted out in the household that I was living in.
And I certainly think I'm still on this journey of learning and taking in. I think just spending a few hours with these two is enough. It's a great opportunity to kind of continue to stretch my mind in terms of what's possible. I have very, very vivid memories of growing up, and I was probably around 7 or 8 years old, and I remember at the first of each month, my mother or father would sit down and start to write out, you know, checks. And one by one, and tear them out, and then put them in the offering envelope, right? And they would place those offering envelopes on their dresser in their bedroom, and then one by one would start to peel them away. And I remember just being in a conversation, and they would just casually talk to us about this. And they would say, you know, yeah, this is a priority for us. You know, we do it before we, buy food. We do it before any of these other things, pay for the mortgage and things. And I just thought, you know, because my family father is a minister at that point, it just didn't make a lot of money. And I thought, wow, that's a really interesting, even at that young age, I thought that was a really interesting priority. And then fast forward to today, I have the privilege of serving a urban youth organization in the Twin Cities called Youth Care. And it's a relatively small nonprofit. And I once a year go up and teach at their camp. I teach the junior counselors who are 15 and 16. It's their first part-time job, right? I did this first time in 2003, and it was a very profound experience of what happened because I taught them a couple hours about money. By the way, it was week two of their working. They got their first paycheck week three, so they had me very strategically placed, right? And at the end of that 2 hours with them, I just made a comment, and I said, you know what would be really cool is if over the course of the summer you pooled some of your resources and made a contribution back to the camp as an expression of gratitude. It's one suggestion, week two. Week 10, they have Visitor's Day where the adults and the young people come together, 300, and it's multicultural group. It's fantastic. And one of the last things that happened on that day in 2003 was the junior counselor stepped forward and made a contribution of $135. And the adults that were there were so moved by that that they started matching their money, and they had put them over $1,000 mark at the end of the day. Mm. Well, I still have those kids sending me emails about thank you for challenging us to look beyond myself. And I mean, so I'm still learning from them, and learning from their that great wisdom of these young people at 15 and 16. So,
well, you were raised. You didn't use the word, but you were raised in a tradition of tithing for the church. But then you applied that in speaking with these young people in a domain outside the ordinary religious meaning of that term.
Most definitely. Yeah. Well, and I think because, you know, in many ways today, I think as people and certainly here and the great work that the Center on Philanthropy has done and also the Lilly Endowment, looking at trends and giving and churches, and it's not really great right now. I mean, let's just put it on the table. I mean, when I'm talking about giving, I'm speaking in this context of financial giving. And that there was a study that the Lilly Endowment funded back in 2000, and a researcher that I know back in the Twin Cities was the head of it, and Jean Roque Partain, and they went out and they asked 100 different churches, what are you doing to meaningfully and proactively engage young people in discussions about giving back, particularly money in this instance? Crickets. 0 for 100. 0 for 100. And so it begs some really interesting, provocative, and thought-provoking questions that I think it's worthy of us, you know, at some point spend a little time.
Well, Bernice, I heard you speaking about tithing in a way that was quite striking to me. Would you share that?
Well, I really like the concept. And so I apply it to myself that and anybody else who is in my sphere. And in this case, it is sort of based on money. It is every dollar you get, 10% has to go someplace else to something else. And you actually get to pick where it goes, but you let it go. And with Sweet Honey and the Rock, 10% of our concerts had to be benefit concerts. Mm. And what it meant for me is that somehow, no matter how little you have, and it's like the example you were given, you absolutely will not be in deficit if you let a percentage of it go and have somebody else to use it in a way they define. And it has something for me to do with building a humane, socially responsible environment in which to live. And it means that if you have access to resources, you don't expend all of those resources. You take a percentage. And I used 10. When Sweet Honey started to do it and we started to calculate, we were very shortly doing 15% of our concerts were benefit concerts. And I never experienced a deficit because of it.
Did your fellow members just immediately take to that, or did
they
you
didn't
have...
like it at all?
Eventually,
is that called imposed generosity, Bernice?
It's interesting. If you have a dollar and you actually retain 90 cents, felt difficult. And I actually have this belief that if you don't do it, you won't prosper. I just have a feeling there is something about moving ahead that's related to your capacity to share what comes into your sphere to make decisions about. And if it comes into your sphere, it is not all yours to determine what happens to it. So I made it a condition of my participation with anything I work in.
Well, that lasted 30 years with Sweet Honey and the Rock. Did it take you that long to persuade them all there?
No, it was. I remember we were doing a tour for Black History Month, and that's 9 concerts in 14 days, and there were no benefit concerts when I looked at it, and I said, I'm not doing the tour. And I said, you know, we have to get benefit concerts or we don't do it. And there were a few years where I had to say it more than once. But I've been out of the group now since 2004, and they are doing more, a higher percentage of benefit concerts today than we did when I was in the group. So it worked.
We talk in philanthropy about the word stewardship, and it's kind of wonkish, but you know it sounds like in-speak. But I think really what it means is at some level what we were talking about, which is that we're responsible not just for our consumption, but for our expenditure, however we're going to live. We were talking about living generously. It's about having people feel higher when they finish that discussion with you than they did, not lower. It's about, you know, taking care of the family that you see and the family that you can't see. It's about ensuring that whatever gift you were given gets plowed into the right way, some to benefit yourself because you need to take care of yourself, but some to benefit others. And just that idea of stewardship is fundamentally at the heart of American philanthropy, but I think it's at the heart of what this entire discussion is about, which is just how are you steward whatever you're given, whether it's the voice and the ability to put on an unbelievable concert or the composition or the ability to write well or the ability to run a great business. How do you choose to live that out? Is it generously or is it miserly? And if it's generously, you know, I'm all with you. I think that there is a positive cycle that happens, but even if it doesn't, that's stewardship. That's about being where we are and using it wisely.
Many people associate stewardship with its specifically religious connotations, and of course it has very strong ones. But the root of the word steward is sty ward, sty as in pig sty or animal sty. The steward was the person who looked after the animals of the community or of the household, on which the survival of the family or the community absolutely dependent.
Right.
So the steward is the one or the ones who take care of those riches, whether it's animals or money or institutions, those riches which benefit the people.
And it's interesting if you take that, you know, the origin of sort of where it came from, and you look at, I don't know if many people here are familiar with the work of the Heifer Project and the great things that they do, and there it is, kind of back to its ways again, which is where you're buying shares of an animal, right? And I found it just a really intriguing way to pull young people into this notion of giving back and investing and sending something overseas and seeing that animal as an economic source, as a way to get a family, you know, moving ahead on this kind of socioeconomic spectrum. But I mean, that's just a great example, I think, of kind of going backwards. But I wanted to ask Patty, because one of the things I had read a while back in the Chronicle on Philanthropy, when this guy, Buffett something, he decided, which good, great reason, I think, to make this generous contribution. I was reading, it was last New Year's Eve, my wife Susan and I were down in Iowa City, and we were at the public library, and I was just glancing through the Chronicle Philanthropy, and there was this interview with you, and it said that when this big gift, you know, or announcement of this gift happened, all of a sudden you started receiving money from kids. They started to send you money, and you were kind of like, what do we do with that? And I'm curious, what did you do with that? And and is there, you know, is it an opportunity? I mean, I think for you all with this great bully pulpit that you have to inspire that next generation to be thinking about that.
When we only had one family's money, it was easy to say, well, the money in this foundation comes from one family. Then you take another family's money, and then what do you say to the next person who offers it? Well, no, we're only going with the two richest people, not the third one. Or not the... So we realize that while we should encourage the people that we're giving to us to look to the many organizations and individuals that they might want to give to, because it sets up a positive cycle where they can directly see what happens, that there was still an appropriate way to say, thank you. We will spend it against the goals of the Gates Foundation. But, you know, Warren Buffett's act was so so generous without thought to himself.
Right.
You know, he didn't want his name on the wall. He didn't want his name on any of the gifts we make. He didn't want credit. He really wants to see that money plowed back into society in the most thoughtful way to return some of the wealth that he was able to make to a stewardship of this planet and of the people on the planet that weren't born in the place he was born, didn't have the parents that he was born with, but that also deserve the right to live more fully. And so we see that inspiring kids and families and other donors. And to that extent, our partnership with the Center on Philanthropy, our partnership with others in the sector, with Social Venture Partners, which we were just talking about, that's training kids, we believe is part of making sure that example that Warren's made and that the Gates family continues to make is really played out.
Is there a danger when we use a phrase, living generously, is there a danger that we too quickly think about money? That we too quickly think about, well, that's how we're generous. We give to church, we give to a foundation, or we give to a cause. When, in fact, there are so many other ways in which, you mentioned earlier, voice, time, etc. But do you think there's a temptation to move too quickly to money and think that that's what generosity is about?
When I actually found that generosity was the theme for the Spirit in Place Festival, I had this little funny thing in my body. And I went and looked up the word. And if you go back, it's like noble-minded and abundance. And it seemed to have this concept of you have excess and you share because you have excess. And coming out of a culture where you were in deficit and most of the time you did not have enough to really sustain yourself, and then crucial to your survival was finding ways to share whatever you had with others. There's this game called Hambone, where you've been around the world going again. What you gonna do when you come back? Well, the hambone was a bone that would somehow get in the hand of somebody on the plantation, and they would use it for flavoring a pot of vegetables. Hmm. And then they passed it around until there was nothing left. So I really like the idea of thinking beyond I've got enough to share, but actually consider how dangerous it would be or is when we live in a culture increasingly where possession is the major indication of success and where it is often that you see people absolutely using everything they get for themselves and not actually taking the opportunity to trying to understand how their survival and the health of their social environment is connected to how they can share with others.
We have these religious traditions, philosophical traditions, artistic traditions that tell us that possessions, material things, are not the measure of well-being, measure of success, or the path to happiness. Why have those become the measures of success and happiness to such an extent in our society?
Well, I mean, you see, today there was some surveys done earlier this year that said now if you live in an urban or near urban kind of community in the United States today, you're subjected to 5,000 advertising impressions per day.
Mm. Per day.
Per day. And the question when I'm in front of young people, I always ask them, okay, how many of those messages encourage you to save and or invest some of your money? And then I always take it the next level and say, and how many of those encourage you to, again, be generous and give back? The point is, we've got to understand the context of sort of where we are today, and that the messages, to your point, Bernice, it's that this overwhelming, you know, drive to success. UCLA does this great, huge study, social value study every year, right, where they interview 100,000 incoming first-year students. And they ask them things like, what reason, why are you here at college? You know, tell us, what is your primary driver for being here? They started these studies back in 1966, this huge social value study. 1966. Well, in 1966, the primary reason was I'm here to pursue something I'm passionate about and make a difference in the world. And the answer, I'm here to pursue something where I can make a lot of money, was, you know, down on the list. Now, that's not saying making a lot of money is a bad thing, okay? But here's what's happened. Now we're at 2007, and the primary reason for students coming into school is I'm here to pursue something, you know, I'm here to get a college education so I can go get a job so I can make a lot of money. And the pursuit of, you know, helping out, contributing to the common good, if you will, is they've literally flipped. So it's not, I would agree with you that I don't think it's just the money thing, but my question is, what's driving that? What has fundamentally happened from a shift that's taken us from here to here?
I'm a little bit more optimistic than you about some of those numbers, because I think you have to be careful. In 1966, most of us that got to go on to college came from some level of stability. And, you know, I see my kids who come from a level of stability able to think about being a game warden or thinking about working in public health. But today, you know, we have kids from a ton of different backgrounds, oftentimes incurring a lot of debt to go to school and concerned about making money. Yet we see things like Teach for America vastly oversubscribed for kids that want to go after they finish. We see Peace Corps and other service elements seeing more demand than they can absorb for students that do believe that a public life is part of their responsibility, whether they go to work for McKinsey in order to get the credibility to go work in the presidential campaign. I mean, I think that kids at some times are putting together assets. They think they want to be able to afford to have a stable family life, but I'm optimistic from what we're seeing in terms of the youth that are both giving as well as planning how to get more involved in the community, that yes, they want to have a decent bank account, but they're seeing a responsibility, whether it's because of climate change, whether it's because of wars they're unhappy with, whether it's because of seeing the decline in social services, that there is a lot of activism from today's college student, but maybe they want to make sure they have a paycheck to go along with it.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything, again, inherently wrong with that. I mean, the reason I do the work that I do is because I am optimistic and I'm hopeful. However, I also see some public policy things that are creating more debt. You know, I see some things that where we're saying, well, you know, we're going to cut down the amount of investing in our college university level, which was going to require more young people to have to take on more debt, right? We're seeing an unfettered access to young people to, you know, engage them in credit cards and then the slippery slope of that debt. And so my question or my concern is that all good. I think that they want to participate. And there is a huge outpouring, I think, of them giving time, right? And time has always been the big predictor, or volunteerism has been the predictor for ultimate financial generosity. But I do question that their ability to follow through on the financial piece of that when their debt is so unprecedented. We haven't seen these kinds of levels of debt today in America.
Another major change since the mid-1960s, when I happened to be an undergraduate, I was a junior in college in 1966, is that, first of all, I think young people at that time had the confidence, naive as it was, that they could make changes in the world. They could improve things. That government was accessible, that business was accessible, that the professions were accessible to change. I think young people today are much less confident of that. But the other major difference is I never thought that I would have to compete in order to get a job with the planet. I just had to compete with people who had comparable training with me in the United States of America.
And it was a pretty small group then, too.
That was a pretty small group. I was a scholarship kid from the Midwest. So I think young people now, and I teach them every day now at Indiana, and have for 36 years at Indiana University, and they're wonderful young people, but they're subjected to all the stresses that you're talking about. Students work more hours every year. I have a student in my class who is taking 15 hours and is working 50 hours a week and is sick and cannot afford to go to the health center. Her family has no insurance and she has no insurance. She's paying her tuition with her 50 hours of work. Nobody I knew when I went to college at public or state universities had that kind of pressure on them. So this gets back to this issue of abundance and scarcity. It's easy to be generous if you've got a surplus, or at least it's easier. But not everybody with a surplus is generous, but at least it's easier to be so. But if you don't really have enough, if you're operating in just on the margins or just below the margins of getting by, then when you act generously, passing that ham bone around or helping your neighbor put a roof on his barn,
or organizing against racism or organizing against the system where young people come out of 2 years of community college or 4 years of undergraduate college with debt, at that point, you actually need to take on the system with action. And when I go to college campuses, I ask students, do you really think it's all right that you live in a society like this that is loading you up on debt with no indication that you'll have a job when you finish? And many of the faculty feel a little guilty because they are teaching students in a field that's glutted, is what they used to call it. And so I actually think that sometimes it is important to understand that in addition to specific resources, you do have the ability to sometimes challenge a system that is actually shifting to debt as a commodity.
As a commodity.
As a commodity. You're buying and selling debt. The other thing you mentioned that I'd like for us to talk about a little is our sacred organizations. And with the large group of religious organizations that say they are followers of the Christ in some way, I sometimes wonder if they even check out on how much trouble this man got into immediately. And he says, you know, to his disciple, you know, you walk with some sandals and a stick, you know. Or what is this thing about shifting that message to support what we are calling prosperity gospel or mega churches? And I'm concerned about the absence of questioning and critique in some of those systems. And there seems to be a manipulation in some of the stuff I see in religious organizations today.
Well, comfortably over half of all charitable giving in America, you might know more accurately what the percentage is, but it's more than 50%, is money given to religious organizations.
Where given to?
Given to religious organizations, churches, synagogues, yes, mosques, and so forth. How is that money used, and has it changed over time?
Well, it's changing dramatically. I mean, there's some research coming out recently this year that just said that the amount of benevolence giving, which is giving outside of their community, you know, giving away from the church, you know, and things that it's not paying staff, it's not building new buildings, right? I mean, it's almost not even detectable anymore. And gosh, if the churches can't be the leaders for looking outside of themselves and challenging us to look outside of ourselves to give and to give away and to model that, I mean, that's a trend that I am deeply concerned about. And now I think the difference, there are more options, if you will, to give today. I mean, to be sure, all kinds of options. You know, the internet opens up you know, loads of things to do. But again, it's back to the who's nurturing, you know, one of the common denominators of any of the great philanthropists. And whether it's those that have come before us or the Gateses or, you know, Mr. Buffett, to a person, they all, almost have all said, someone needed to nurture that spirit of generosity in me. It didn't just happen through a click, osmosis, or something. There was that intentional nurturing. And what I don't see a lot of churches doing that, particularly across the generational lines, is particularly with young people, is how do we inspire them to be those generous people in their lives?
Well, yeah, you told it about working with your granddaughter, for example, and giving her your notion of tithing, which didn't immediately strike her as a best way to use a modest income. And you talked about your parents and their impact on you, and you talked about your parents. And obviously not everybody learns, if they're going to learn the practice of generosity, not everybody learns it from a grandmother or grandfather or parents, but most do. That is, if they're going to learn it, that's where, in fact, most people learn it. Are there ways that parents can foster a greater sense of generosity and compassion and concern and caring in their children or grandchildren?
Well, we touched on it earlier, which is I also think this idea of immediately giving of their time and seeing not only that there's a gap between the way things are and the way things should be, but that they're responsible for that, for doing something about that gap, and that they're powerful in it. Because I think when you look back and you say, why didn't we do more about apartheid? Why didn't we take more action on issue X? Why didn't we do more before whatever political conflict we're uncomfortable with? It's not usually because we didn't care. We did care. It's because we thought that what we would do wouldn't matter. And one of the things we have to teach our kids, besides getting them to put the money away, is that they have power and responsibility that unless they're using it, it just dissipates. And when I said you have money and you have time and energy and you have voice, I still believe that voice is the most underutilized asset probably in this room, in this city, in this country, that we are, you know, we are not getting either the government we want, the public education we want, the civil actions we want because we're not acting. So you've got to teach your granddaughter to act, but I'm guessing she is an actor already.
Yes. I do think it has to be taught, and example is important. But having formulas to actually try out these systems are very important. And sometimes I think if you don't use your voice, it actually doesn't dissipate. It is subsumed by others who actually include you. And so sometimes I think if you don't speak, somebody else uses that space, probably for something you don't care about. And so you need to occupy very strongly any space you have to sort of testify or witness to what you believe and care about.
I'll give you one example, so strongly to agree with your point. I'm a tenured professor at a public university and have been for 25 years. And tenure at a university is one of the great privileges. Think of any other profession where your job cannot be outsourced, you can't be taken over by a competitor, and you can say whatever you want as long as it's responsible. And this privilege is the least used power in the American university system. Tenured faculty across this country, there are exceptions, noble, worthy exceptions, but by and large are so busy pursuing their own careers as opposed to devoting their intelligence and their training and their gifts to addressing pressing public needs and raising their voices. It's an enormous resource that is scarcely used in this society.
I would say there's only one group that has a similar, and that's the Supreme Court, but they have to vote.
Right.
But they have the same job security.
They do, unfortunately.
He said that.
That was not a partisan comment because you don't know what judges I went off the court. Although my friends can guess, right? So,
well, one of the things I was going to offer up about voice is I do wonder where who's going to teach that next generation to be vocal and to teach them to what I mean? What will it take for them to stand up and say, you know, it's not okay to addict us to spending and to participate in a lifetime of debt? I mean, in 1980 in this country, the craziest thing happened. We instituted a law that prohibits the Federal Trade Commission from enacting any legislation that regulates advertising to children.
Say it again.
Yeah. So in 1980, we enact this law that says that the FTC has no ability to oversee or to put in place, right, provisions that will prevent the, I mean, pretty much whatever you can dream up when it comes to children in terms of ways to advertise to them. It's just straight out there, right? So they were prevented from enacting any laws that allow what I would call a more saner sort of dialogue. And so in 1980, it wasn't a big deal because not a lot of people had figured out that kids had a lot of money. But then now today, you know, fast forward, they figure the consumer product people believe that if you have a child living at home, they influence up to 80% of all product purchases. And now if you understand that we have a $13 trillion economy and that 70% of it is by us, do the math. So I wonder, and I say to young adults, you know, I say, what will it take for you to stand up and say that is not appropriate? Exactly. And I hear a lot of silence. And it does concern me. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't young people out there doing noble things. I mean, most definitely. But I think that we're in an interesting spot in this country when it comes to this. And we're seeing it in full force with subprime lending and, you know, the list goes on. And again, I do wonder about our capacity to manage those things.
What would you do?
Well, first of all, I would look really hard at that issue of unfettered access to young people, because we know it has direct impact on the obesity issue, and that's been, in a good way, we've raised that up. But no one has really addressed it from the consumer perspective. I think Google does great things. Right, I think they're a really interesting company. And they have real interesting values at their company, which is, you know, no conspicuous consumption. But there they are, getting ready. They really want to launch a new phone, which allows us to have preferences of what we put in the phone, so that if I'm driving in a neighborhood, they can say, hey, you're in the neighborhood. You just stopped in the store the other day. If you come in and show us your phone, we'll give you 10% off the next purchase if you come in today. Right? That's a lot of power. I mean, there's more cell phones in the world than there are computers and televisions combined. So you now start to think about the economic impact of that. So is it regulation? I don't know. But I think that the scales have kind of gone so far in terms of just let's grant access. And I think now we're starting to see some of the negative implications of that, you know, coming forward.
I think, though, there's another piece around voice that we have to be careful about. And that is sometimes when we see people act, it's like being in a boardroom and you say something and you're a woman and you're black and the conversation is picked up as if you had not said anything. Mm. And I remember in Ohio looking at those students in that voting precinct staying in line after midnight to vote. Now, I know the local committee knew they had increased voters from that college. And having two booths and having one broken down was intentional. The news showed you the line, showed you people coming to bring the students food, the students saying, absolutely, we are staying here. But I wondered about the follow-up and whether the local committee was sued for fraud, intentional fraud. So sometimes when you speak and you get a moment, but you have no idea whether it rippled. And I wondered whether the president of that college took on the local board, or whether the political science department created a course the next year so that they would do research, so that we'd be looking at a new voter board in that community. So sometimes we do speak, and one way of dealing with the fact that we are voicing is to pretend that we said nothing or that we don't exist. And so sometimes I think it is very important to not only talk about the need, but also be very conscious when people come on board and actually act. Because we got a lot of new young voters in this last election. A lot of new young voters. And I'd really like to see that number increased. In the state of Florida, they were thrown off the rolls and not allowed to vote. And I'd like to see what happens the next go round. But I think we have to be careful about that also.
We talked about some of the ways in which generous living is learned, where the inspiration might come from, often from families. What about public figures? And you mentioned this was the woman who really had a public identity, but she wasn't world famous or even nationally famous, but she was famous in the eyes of all the people who knew of her work. What about public figures? Are there examples, either living or from the past, that you look back to or think on as inspiration for living generously?
Well, I think, you know, a couple people come to mind. I think a gentleman that, when my parents were running this Lutheran camp in central Wisconsin, I had the great privilege of being mentored by a gentleman from Trinidad. And he was of Indian descent, and he was a Presbyterian. And long and short of it, he was up studying in central Wisconsin to get his teaching ultimately and then master's degree. And so he worked at the camp and lived there even during some of the winter months. And it was just fascinating. So my family went down and when I was in sixth grade, and we visited their family in Trinidad. And I mean, it was just unspeakable generosity. And what they did to welcome us into that community was just stunning. And in terms of, you know, actual, you know, wealth, if you will, I mean, they really did not have. But they pulled out all the stops. And that their act of kindness and generosity was just, I mean, it's something I'll never forget. And how he returned that, our, you know, that generosity was tenfold. And that was very inspirational.
In Atlanta, Shirley Franklin is the mayor, and the Martin Luther King papers were coming up for auction. And I think it was Sotheby's, and they said, I hope there will be somebody in the country, this country, who will make sure the papers stay in the United States of America. And they were trying to say that if these papers go on auction, there'll be very few people in this country who will be able to challenge some of the people who will be trying to buy it from outside of the country. And Franklin, who's mayor of Atlanta, decided she had to actually get those papers before they went on auction. And she cleared her calendar for 2 weeks and did not stop until, in fact, she was successful. And I just looked at where we could have been. And now the papers are in Atlanta, Georgia, and they are going to be housed at Morehouse College. Mm-hmm. But it really sometimes, in this case, this is a public figure who said, no, I don't think we're going to let that happen in this country.
I want to give one locally, too. Mm-hmm. I grew up under Mayor Lugar, who's now Senator Lugar, of course, is one of the most senior players, and I often have differences with his political choices. Well, but he has been probably the most effective member of Senate on consistently and reliably listening to the community that identifies important and smart ways to address HIV/AIDS, to do something about foreign aid, to actually put the right kind, if we're inclined towards military power, there's other power we need to use too, and whether it's his work on nuclear power, trying to work with Senator Nunn on a lot of that, but the other things that Senator Lugar has done that probably didn't win him votes, but was a way for him to use the political capital that he had built up on behalf of others, showed that even political figures you might not agree with on this set of things will and can step forward against the things that they believe in. And he's been a fabulous mentor and advisor and supporter of efforts here in Indiana, whether it's at IU, but around the globe to do something about HIV/AIDS.
Do we live in a generous society? Would you characterize, imagining looking at America from the outside, we can't do that objectively, but just trying to imagine that, and looking at America and how we treat one another, how we treat the land, how we provide for future generations, how we treat people from other countries. Are we a generous society? Or how, that's too how generous are we?
So I believe we're very generous. Mm-hmm. We're not very smart, but we're very generous. So... a lot of the numbers support the fact that we're generous. It's not just rich people in this country that are generous. I think that the numbers from Jean Temple's organization are something like 65% of families under $100,000 a year have given money last year to some cause they believe in, maybe their church, but many other causes. That's more than voted. Okay, so that's not very smart. We write a check. we write a check to the government, or somehow the government gets a larger share than we're writing to philanthropy. But we're not taking the opportunity to influence those government dollars. We're not taking the opportunity to influence the other community efforts, the political dollars. So I think we're generous, and I, by the way, think that that if you reassorted people to where their next door neighbor was in need. We like to say the Gates Foundation. If you had somebody with malaria next door, we'd probably solve malaria. But the fact that it's far away, that we got rid of it in this country, makes it harder to understand. When people understand and can see and look into the eyes of the problem, I believe we have baked in the inclination, except for people with real problems, mm-hmm. we have baked in the inclination to be generous, to try to cover that gap between what you have and what I have and what you need and what I might have, even if I don't have a surplus, just what you need. And I see that in the slums of Delhi, people that haven't got a thing. Grandmothers carrying babies for miles to just make sure they get their polio vaccination so that they're not afflicted with something we got rid of here decades ago. I believe we have a generous spirit. I believe we are not very well educated about how to make the most of that spirit. Mm-hmm.
And I think outside of this country, it is thought that it's because we don't know. We don't get good information. I was in Paris coming up to a presidential election, and the guy said, Dr. Regan, you have to go home so you can vote because we're worried about you. Or I've heard people
I've heard
say
that from cab drivers in unbelievable places. Did you want to tell us how to fix our country? Let's talk about yours.
Or the idea of, do you know that you are not getting good news?
Oh, that's interesting.
You just don't get good information. You're good people, but they're not giving you good news.
Which feeds into... That's interesting.
If you really got better information, it would help us out a lot.
Well, and I do. I think inherently that I think people are they have that generous spirit. I tend to think that, and I talk to families about this, and I'm still working on it and actually going to start researching it shortly this year, about do we have a dominant kind of characteristic of a temperament, particularly as I think about money, right? You know, if you're born with sort of a dominant generosity, sort of sharing characteristic, what does that look like? Or if you're born with more saving and spending, because what we're trying to understand is if you do have that dominant characteristic, what do you need to do to sort of nurture the other ones that perhaps are less dominant, right? But in back to the point of generosity, I think so. But I think that it means intentionality. I think it's really critical that we have intentional systems and processes, as both Patty and Bernice have alluded to, that help that next generation lift them up and show them the way. It doesn't mean to tell them, you know, how to be generous, but I think it's giving them an opportunity to sort of to be generous. So I'm very hopeful. I mean, it's curious to me that even in the midst of 5,000 messages a day telling me to do something other than perhaps be generous, right? One counter rhythm, well placed, yields a different behavior. That's very much worth celebrating.
Yes.
From young people who the money that they earn is mostly for needs, not wants. And if they can do it and they can show us the way, then we should all lift them up and celebrate that and create more people like them.
What about the way we treat one another as a society? Are we generous in terms of caring for those who are most in need in our society?
Well, again, I think we go back to public responsibility. We have to be careful not to confuse our individual responsibility
yes.
with our government and mm-hmm. public responsibility, too. I had just been going to interject because I think that one of the things we really need to do is make sure that kids in this country get a good education. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I think we are all failing miserably at even saying that it is an injustice in this system, in this country, to say we have a public education system and to systematically and routinely have a third of kids never get a high school diploma. One third of kids.
That's right. That's right.
Any business, you know, if we had one third of blocks with potholes, although I would say that coming on the interstate from the airport, you certainly have a lot of bumps. But if one third of the street had a pothole, you know, any other system that failed at a one out of three, the business leader would be fired. Everybody would be gone. Well, we are the ones who are responsible for whether or not this public education system gets turned around in this country, and we are systematically ensuring that one third of our kids don't have an adequate education for college, work, or citizenship. And what we're talking about is being able to play out citizenship. So I think the responsibility really starts with ensuring that as public leaders, because if you even landed in a seat here today or got up and are headed to a Colts game today, you have a responsibility and the assets to do something about the public system that isn't serving citizens at the level that it has to, so that whatever incremental generosity we can add to that can take us to a new level instead of the base level that is supposed to be a public right in this country.
Here's a related statistic, which I'm sure you know, which is that the average length of career for a person trained to teach in primary and secondary education in America is 5 years.
What did you say?
5 years. That's the average length of a teacher's career in elementary and high school.
And then they're out of education?
Pardon?
And then they're out of education.
They're out of education. So obviously some people are there for a year and they figure it's not for them, and others are 10, 12, 15 years.
Sure.
So it's an average figure.
Has that been, I'm assuming...
It's going down.
Okay.
It's going down. And again, imagine, we train physicians, we train lawyers, we train people with MBAs, we train musicians. Imagine if they, on average, pursued that career for 5 years. We would feel, or engineers, we would feel there was something catastrophically wrong with the realm in which they were working.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we can't blame it on those people. So
they're making rational choices, is my guess. People generally do. So they're making a choice not to teach for some rational reason.
Right.
And we need to figure out what that is and change those reasons.
Because we need experienced teachers. Yeah. And we need smart, committed people. And Lord knows there are a lot of smart, committed people in the public schools across this country. But there aren't enough. And their conditions are not good enough. And so one thing we would want to have in a society where we treat one another generously is excellent public education. What else would we want?
Well, healthcare. I mean, when you look at the travesty that we couldn't invest in healthcare in this country, what we're doing now with that SCHIP program, I mean, that's just insanity to me. I mean, it's insanity. I mean, basic healthcare. You know, and you juxtapose that against how much we're willing to invest militarily. And, I mean, I just wonder about our values. Because again, I think that it's back to the notion of, you know, just the... Bernice, when we were talking earlier, she mentioned this notion of why wouldn't you want to contribute to the... Who would want to live in a society where you can contribute to that common good and to help others in need or in, you know, who are economically oppressed or whatever that issue is? I mean, why don't we all have something at stake here to invest in? And I think that's enormously important for us. And those are gut policy issues that we have to come to grips with in this country. And as I think it was either Thomas Friedman... Or Paul Krugman in the Times, when New York Times, when they said the best way that you can impact that is by voting.
You know, in a lot of what you've said, Bernice, I've heard you talking about a way of being that where you care about the conditions of the people around you, that you can't separate your own fate, your own prosperity, your own well-being from how well the folks around you are getting on. And that generosity is an ethical response, but it's also a practical response.
Yes, I do think that it's, if you wake up in the morning and find out you're not dead, if you last through the day, people who run into you ought to know what you stand for. I just don't go for this invisibility stuff. I don't go for positions where you get your work done in a way that nobody else knows you did it, and so they assume that your boss did the work. And the idea that you actually would do well to risk your life for what you believe in. Would do well. It would be okay. It's somebody else's job to take you out. But if they're not going to take you out, they need to be hearing what you believe. And one person can make a difference. And one ways you can make a difference is if you sound your voice, you'll find harmony lines. I've never done anything by myself. Never had to do anything by myself. But I've never waited for a crowd to step out. And I think it's very important to not waste the opportunity that life, what we call life, offers to us and to the culture we move through. And I think we are needed. We are absolutely needed. But we are needed as very active, proactive agents. And so what if you had gone tomorrow? I'll sing at your funeral.
You all get to write that down.
Yeah, right.
Well, or I'll be dead with you.
Well, and I think too that, I mean, I really appreciate that, and I would take that even, you know, the Mother Teresa had this wonderful saying. She said, don't wait for the leaders.
Yes.
Do it alone, person to person. And it's that whole notion of stepping out and making change. And I, too, believe that we can all, again, and I'll kind of put this lens of money on it, but I try to inspire across the generational lines and watch young people inspire those older than them around this notion of the choices we make with our money can change the world. And it's so fundamentally true, but rarely does a young person hear that. Rarely do we have an expectation for them to kind of get out and lead the way. We just need to get out of the way and let them do it.
And Nathan opened the door, so I'll just add, you know, people often refer to Mother Teresa, and I would say that speaking to Bernice's point about persistence, I mean, now we know that even Mother Teresa had her doubts along the way, right?
Absolutely.
And I actually think that's a good message, you
absolutely.
Know, that she had her doubts, and she plowed through anyway, knowing there could be, that she could make some change, and she was going to do it. And one of the things we need to make sure that not just our kids, but all of us realize is that, you know, it's easy to stand on the stage and talk about this, but, you know, there's going to be days where you don't know if it's making a difference or not. And
right.
And guess what? You got to go back at it. And one of the things we need to make sure the kids get, besides a good education, is this example of persistence. And the idea that, you know, if they don't listen to you the first time, you go back again, and you go back again, and you go back again. And I think that that really is part of this, that resilience and persistence as well as generosity and a good education are critical in all of this.
Would you be willing to retell your encounter with Nelson Mandela? I'm thinking about where he asked the room his two questions about...
I actually have two stories about Nelson Mandela.
Right.
One very one inspiring, the other one very human. So I'll start with the very, very human one, which is, you know, I obviously give away money, right? That's what I do. And so I sat down with him and his wife, who's a formidable and impressive philanthropist, but also leader of all kinds, Gracia Michel. And they had this plan, and I said, look, we're really excited about this, and we'd really like to fund it. And I named the amount we wanted to fund it at. And he was the first person who ever said to me, I'm sorry, ma'am, I want to see your boss. Because he knew he could do better. And sure enough, that night, he did better. So that's a man that we already knew had persistence and resilience, and I saw it firsthand.
But that's what 25 years in jail was.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
He wasn't going to stop at the millions I put on
that's
the table.
Right.
He was ready to go further, and he doubled his money through that one go-around. So normally it doesn't work, but for him it certainly did.
Try that.
Yeah. You'll notice that I said normally it doesn't work. The story that you remember is one that actually really changed my use of the 11-plus years I've had the pleasure of helping Gates and now the Buffett family build their giving. But early in the time of the foundation, President Mandela came to Seattle to meet us and talk about the work he wanted to do with his foundation. It was the same trip, actually, but also to reach out to the community. And I was in a hall very much like this one, very much like this one, full of Seattle community leadership, people that had really been at the forefront of shaping Seattle into a really fabulous community. And I was standing right there off stage, and he was standing at this podium, and he had talked about HIV/AIDS and talked about development in Africa and colonialism and all kinds of things that really, what he thought about our foreign policy, and had gone through a lot, and the audience was rapt. And then towards the very end of his remarks, he stopped a moment and literally with no hint of frustration or anger, looked at the audience and said, would any of you who did something, anything, to change apartheid, please stand up? And then he said, and would any of you who did absolutely anything to help me walk free from Robben's Island, please stand up? And the 60 seconds that followed were the most uncomfortable collective feeling that I have ever witnessed and hope to ever witness again, because there were many people who could stand up, but none of them really felt that they had done enough. And there were many, many people who couldn't stand up. And to a person, I think, we all looked and said, why didn't we do more, to my remarks earlier? And that was where I really identified. Why didn't we do more? It was a room full of activists, a room full of people who believed in the fight he was fighting. Why didn't we do more? And I don't think it was because a single person didn't care. I believe it was most people thought that what they would personally do would not matter. Right. And yet he stood there as an example of the fact that individual persistence, resilience, and character, but also collective persistence, resilience, outrage, activism could change the world. And it really was a lesson for everyone in that room that we don't want to be standing or sitting in the audience when the next Nelson Mandela stands up and asks us, just please stand. What did you do about public education in Indianapolis? What did you do about how we spend our government dollars? What did you do about homelessness and the issues of health care? And we can't all do everything, but there truly, my experience there was that there is no excuse for us not to be able to stand up.
Is there a danger, as I suggested in my opening questions, that we've become aware of so many needs, such grave needs, in our neighborhoods, in our country, around the world, that we can feel overwhelmed? There's this term, compassion fatigue. Every emergency calls forth support for people who are suffering some acute crisis. But there are all these chronic challenges: malaria, childhood malnutrition, public education, and on and on. Is there a danger that the more aware a young person becomes of the needs in the world, the more numbed or paralyzed they might become just by the scale of it?
Sure, I would say, perhaps, but I think there's a great tool out on the Central Indiana Community Foundation, their website. And it's three or four pages, and it just asks you to identify, what are your values, right? And it's really intended to be kind of a family exercise. What are your values? What are the causes that are really you're passionate about? And it's, sort of proactively starting to lead you down the path of focusing your ideas, right? And I think that being overwhelmed is actually okay. And I think the notion of being overwhelmed is a really important thing to take on, because it helps you understand the magnitude of the issues that are out there. Because I think I heard this great preacher preach this excellent sermon, and he said, hope without a plan is denial. And it's that whole notion that I hope starvation, I hope malaria goes away, I hope economic oppression goes away, but the whole notion is if we don't have a plan, an action plan, that it probably won't get better. So it's that very simple notion of taking and channeling, feeling overwhelmed and letting that feeling of being overwhelmed, it's okay. But then what's the danger is where you become frozen. And it's inactivity, right? Inaction. But then how do you let that feeling of being overwhelmed and then channel that and say, okay, I'm going to focus on this thing, like with Patty and their family and the food shelter here in town. I mean, that's a fantastic example of just going after something and just staying on it.
One of the things that Warren Buffett gave us when he gave the foundation $35 billion was very little advice, but one that has been an unbelievable blessing, which is that he said, look, I'm not going to dictate how you have to spend it. There were very few terms, besides the fact we had to spend it rapidly because he didn't want it sitting in a bank someplace. He wanted to see it changing society now. But the other one was that he preferred that we go deeper, not wider.
Yeah.
And the reason is that it is easy, I think, to lose focus. As voters, we can vote across a wide range of things. As actors and voices, you do have to choose. You have to look at those values. You have to line up the things that you want to learn about and focus on, and then continue to iterate, you know, decide, learn, meet the players in the space, find out more about the issues, because, you know, as Bernie said, we're not given the information easily. It takes some digging and oftentimes takes some networking to meet people that are doing good work, that are doing good work over time, to learn about history in that space, to continue to open your eyes and ears and networks to learning. So in spite of the extraordinary wealth of the Gates Foundation, we've chosen 22 things only. And it isn't that we, you know, one of them is, you know, change the life for small farmers around the world. That's a big thing. But we're trying to focus even with the extraordinary opportunity we have so that we can learn deeply and be wise and be open to feedback. The kinds of things, you know, if you take on too much, you become an acting machine and not much of a listening device. And, you know, you can get out in front of your learning if you try to do too much. And I think that the answer for overwhelmed is focus and learn deeply about a small set of things you wish to change so you're more powerful in the process.
Bernice, I'm so haunted by what you were saying about one's voice not being heard. You talk and talk, and then the conversation goes on as though you hadn't, not you personally, but as though this person hadn't said anything.
Yeah, me personally, yeah.
Well, you personally, all right. You did say that, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember that. And yet, some people will, and this is the discouragement factor. Some people will say these problems are enormous, or this corruption of whatever is so deep, it's implacable. And I went out and I stood in line, or I signed my petition, or I made my phone calls, and nothing happened. And so I'm just going to quit. But others don't. Others talk louder or figure out another way to make their point or increase the size of the folks harmonizing so that finally you get to a mass that can't be ignored. What is it that accounts for that courage or whatever it is, persistence, stubbornness, that keeps some people going when they haven't been heard?
I actually recommend not swinging at every pitch. And you will have many opportunities to make a difference. If you go through the door 1 out of 5, you will be doing very well. And what it really means is you do not, it's almost like what you're talking about, Mother Teresa, do not think you can actually be at the same place on the issue at every point. Some days you don't get out of bed. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you are connected with enough people, so if you're 2 days and they don't see you show up, they will come check on you. But it is very, very important to not get grandiose about what you can do and how it will save the world or the universe, or require that before you act, you have to be sure it's going to work. And, you know, yes, every other time is fine in terms of finding the courage to speak, finding the time to say something when, in fact, you will think it's going to actually not receive an applause after you finish. So it will make you last longer. And we have a fix-it thing in our culture. You know, Jenna comes up and we say, didn't we march about that 30, 40 years ago? And we want to do something, take care of a problem, and it's done. And human life and human culture is not like that. You have to be prepared to always be charging the culture you live in with the things that you feel makes that culture a vibrant, supportive one for the planet and for those of us who share the planet.
Vaclav Havel, the great Czech writer and dissident and president and ex-president, made a distinction between optimism and hope that I have found very useful. Optimism, he says, is the attitude that things are going to turn out just fine and that what you do is going to certainly produce the results you want. That's optimism. Hope, he said, is the deep sense that however dire the conditions, there's something worth doing and that you ought to just do it. You don't need to know, you can't know how it will turn out, whether it will change things, whether it will solve the problem. You just have to know that it's the right thing to do and then do it. And if it is the right thing to do, your doing it will attract other people to work on it. So if even if you start out alone, you will not end up alone. I want to come back to this word risk that you gave us earlier, because it seems to me that risk and a variation on that, the word sacrifice. These are words that we get a little leery about when we're talking about generosity. Again, if you have an abundance, if you have a surplus, and you give some of it away, well, that's a good thing to do. But it doesn't really require you to risk anything. It doesn't require you to sacrifice anything. But the most profound changes in a society come about when people are willing to make actual sacrifices, including physical risk, psychological risk, risking careers. Can you talk about any experiences you may have had or witnessed where people actually had to take real risks?
Well, for me, I was... I was in Lower Manhattan on 9/11, right? So, you know, it's just... that's a real, you know, deep thing for me on a whole host of fronts. But I remember a couple things that happened sort of in the, just the unspeakable sort of craziness of that day. First, to let people know that I was okay, of course. But something just, I remember standing in line on the 12th of September at St. Vincent's because I had to do something. And so I stood online at St. Vincent's Hospital for about 8 hours to give one pint of blood, right? And I'll never forget people coming up to, you know, standing in line outside of the building and, have you seen my mother? Pictures, right? Have you seen my father, my uncle, my brother, my husband, my wife? I mean, it was just one person after the other, right? And then by the third, and I was in that thing they called the frozen zone. And I was, again, I was out there for a conference at NYU, and I remember driving home, and I heard this sort of admonition from the president to get back to normal and to head to the mall, right? And it was at that moment that I said, I gotta change, you know, I've got to step out of that. I've got to take some risk. And I feel like I'm a, you know, a fairly well-read person, you know, wanting to step out. But it was at that moment that I decided that you've got to move forward, you know, with Share, Save, Spend and Inspire. So.
That's a great story.
Any risk or sacrifice?
I just, one recognition, which is I spent, as you mentioned, 20 years in the technology industry before quitting and then getting this unbelievable opportunity to help the Gates family start their philanthropy. But I thought I worked with really smart, dedicated, hardworking people in the technology sector. And I've got to tell you, the last 11 years in the nonprofit field, whether it's in Africa or India, I've met so many. But I want to tell you about some people I met last week, because it might make you a little uncomfortable, but I think I should tell you anyway. Because I think there's individual risk, and then there's also collective risk. And a lot happens when groups decide not only to individually use the social capital they have, but to come together and use it. And I spent a significant part of last week, I called my mother right before headed out because she was going through a move, and It was 4:30 in the morning in Hyderabad, India, and I was headed out for a day in brothels. And the reason that I was going to brothels is because we have a project in India to try to ensure that the AIDS epidemic there does not take off at the level that it has in Africa. And in epidemiologists and scientists believe that a lot of that means you have to really help those who are most at risk of contracting AIDS protect themselves and protect whoever else they're having sex with. So we have 4,000 of the most mobilized, risk-taking sex workers you have ever met that are working across India to try to work with others like themselves to protect themselves, to protect their clients, and to keep HIV/AIDS at bay in India. And these women who, 5 years ago we started this project, would tell unbelievable stories of what the police would do to them on a daily basis and you know, what their clientele would do if they ever suggested having protected sex, and what would happen to them if they spoke out in any kind of a political setting, had managed to, over the course of 4 or 5 years, bring their own social capital bear, come together collectively. They had deals with the police, and when I asked the police captain, what made you change? He said, you just don't want those women to show up very often. You know, they were the toughest, you know, most demanding, and that will cause a lot of people to back down from behavior they shouldn't be doing in the first place. And in that particular case, the kind of police harassment that was happening that made it difficult for them to protect themselves, the kinds of negotiations they had to make with their male clients, the situation they had to make with the town council to allow themselves to be protected. These people had completely turned around and had taken personal risk. They were at risk every day of their life, but they had decided to use some of their personal capital to change the situation in society for themselves and for the rest of India. And, you know, I think that when someone whose very existence day to day is at risk chooses to use some of what they have to make the situation better for others, that's just an unbelievable example of how much we could do as individuals.
Yeah. Does anything occur to you, Bernice, that you'd like to speak to?
Just the thing that came to me at the Smithsonian when I was under fire. And I actually had this thought that came into my mind. It's like, I did not hire me, and I was not going to fire me. Everything between those two points belonged to me. And I would just be devastated if I got fired for trying to do what I thought they thought I should be doing, rather than my understanding of what my work was supposed to be. And I was very surprised a year later to still be there. I really went for broke, and I was still standing. And occasionally, it doesn't happen every time, but occasionally, if you can find those spaces, it's interesting to step out. It's like stepping off a cliff in a cloud, so you can't tell whether it's a cliff or whether there's actually a road or a bridge. And I had no idea what would happen. All I knew was that I was supposed to be the specialist at Smithsonian in African American culture. And either I was or I wasn't. And that's all I had. And it really, you can feel the risk. And it is a very lonely place, and a lot of people don't like you. But sometimes you live to have gray hair.
Or you color it up, one or the other.
or no hair.
Yeah, there's that too. That's an option. That's an option.
I'm sure the audience all along has formulated many, many questions they would love to put to these three remarkable people. But that isn't feasible with an audience of this size, and which is why the organizers have invited these two fine representatives of the community to put their questions. So once again, we'll hear questions from Judith Cibula and Jane Henniger.
You all have just been talking about the fallacy in thinking that what you do doesn't matter, that because we don't think we personally can create change, and the fallacy of that. But what about the impact on generosity of our belief, either individually or collectively, that things can't change, that we'll always have poverty, that we can't have a society where everyone has health care? What's the impact of that, those beliefs on our generosity, either individually or collectively?
You're just basically saying when we think it's hopeless, what does that do? And it's when we think it's hopeless, we don't act, right? And so the flip side of belief is immobility or even inertia. I mean, I often think that philanthropy should really be about creating innovations, scaling some form of implementation, supporting and supporting some critical implementation, or doing something about inertia. I mean, things have a tendency to just carry on and not to change at the level that they could be changed. And, you know, it doesn't take large gifts to make that happen. It takes people sitting down and working together with a set of beliefs. So, I mean, I think, if I understand your question correctly, that it belief that you put a bigger challenge out there, that you just have to have belief it's right. But I would also say that besides right, people do want to have some sense that there's something I can budge here, even if it's just making the right people look the information closely in the face.
And I think it's also about setting realistic goals, right? Rabbi Harold Kushner has an interesting book called Overcoming Life's Disappointments. And he talks about this idea of what happens in life when, you know, you can't reach that thing that you had set out, and that's okay. You know, that sometimes we just don't achieve that. But I think some of it is about, on the front end, saying, what is possible? What can I do in my own way? What's realistic? What can I plug into? But to me, I'd so rather have people, you know, trying and not succeeding than just not having done anything at all. And there's, you know, scores of people in history who have set great examples of that.
Hoosiers have a very interesting history of seeing ourselves as polite people, sometimes too polite. I mean, I think there are some wonderful exceptions to that. But often we see ourselves as very polite.
Are you saying that you're more polite than Minnesota Nice, like Garrison Keillor more polite than that?
Possibly. Possibly, although I won't take on Garrison Keillor, right. I promise. But that raises some interesting thoughts about what happens to activism and raising our voices as acts of generosity. And I'm curious if each of you would be willing to share with us some thoughts about experiences you've had or chapters from world history of where you've seen that change. Because I'm not suggesting that politeness is all bad, but maybe our times warrant another attempt.
I really don't know anything about who's just being polite. The Klan comes out of this state, right? And what's that guy named Bobby Knight?
He's from Ohio.
Yeah, we don't claim
really?
Him anymore.
But outside of this state, there is a different perception of Indiana. And I think probably, you know, there's a good balance between those of you who think that you're polite and those of you that we hear about who could use some of that notion of politeness. When I think about politeness from my culture, it is going to school and teachers teaching us in a European cultural way that women are supposed to sit on a stage with their legs crossed. Like this. And then your voice is supposed to be at a certain level. And I've never found any use in it. And so I if it gets you someplace for a minute, use it, but don't go for broke with it. If I'm sitting like this on a stool, it is very difficult to push me over. But if I'm sitting like this on a stool, I could blow at you and you'd fall. So I learned, if you've seen a Sweet Honey concert, we're sitting like this. And then we wear clothes so we can sit like this. And people would talk about, how come you, a group of black women, sitting on stage wide-legged? And I said, you know, it looks good. I don't go for it at all, the polite thing. And I think it's probably a misnomer that you think that you are polite.
You recall the incident in 19th century United States that one senator killed another senator. And the Senate passed rules thereafter about how you had to address your fellow senators. And so, and we're all accustomed to this. And subsequently, one senator said, my esteemed senator here from Minnesota, whom I hold in the lowest possible high regard.
As polite.
That's polite, yeah.
As politeness for you.
Exactly.
Question inspired by the Colts game, which will start conveniently after we're finished here today. And I'm just wondering whether generosity, our ability to give and share, is in any way a zero-sum equation. For instance, what about the money and time and emotional energy that we devote to professional sports or other kinds of sports in this country? Does that detract from what we are able to share in other ways with people and with our community?
Positively, absolutely, unequivocally, yes.
Now, speaking for Toshi Regan, who's my daughter, what's your problem with professional sports? I mean, if you don't want to watch the game, don't watch the game.
But here's a little number to put it in perspective for you and for your granddaughter, right?
No, this is my daughter.
Oh, your daughter, sorry.
Middle age.
Got it. Tailgating in America is a $12 billion industry. $12 billion.
What was this?
Tailgating. $12 billion. Tailgating. You know, the art of...
eating chicken off of your...
Exactly.
...the back of your car.
Right. Before a game, when you see all the people out in the parking lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have heard that because of the significance of this game, that number has been adjusted upwards to $13 billion. but I think, to the point seriously, though, I think that, I think it can be a distraction. I can watch sports with the best of them, but I think the amount of time and energy that we give to that is pretty significant. It's interesting, as I've been driving through town, and I've seen at some of the churches on their signage,
"Go Colts."
Go Colts. Go Colts.
Yep.
And I wondered if they would do the same if it were "Go Pepsi," you know, or "Go," I don't know, Target or something. I just wonder about that. I mean, I understand there's this community sort of spirit with that.
That is interesting.
But it just kind of struck me as, and that's, I thought about that, and I wondered, I wonder, is there some kind of a double standard there?
Each year when I do this, I have to say at least one offensive thing to the community. Some years, many more than one. And I'm going to point out, the audience probably has a richer estimate than I do of how many pages of the Indianapolis Star were devoted in this past 7 days to this football game. 30, 50 pages? How many articles were there about this gathering? Zero. Zero. You have the most, among the most thoughtful people in this community gathering here to talk about a profoundly important theme that affects all aspects of our lives together. And the city newspaper could not see its way to publish an article about it. That is shameful, it seems to me. But it's also a measure of how distorted the attraction is. I played sports. I like sports. But the amount of attention that we give to sports and the amount of money we invest in sports in this society is grotesque. Probably two
Scott,
more questions.
Do we have time for two?
Two
I'll
questions.
I'll ask one,
yes.
And then Jane will ask one,
yes.
Too. Is that okay? Okay. Taxes in Indiana are a very big issue lately. And Jane's going to talk about taxes. Crime is also a very big issue, particularly in Indianapolis and in neighborhoods like the one I live in downtown. I'm curious if you could talk about how fear affects our capacity to be giving, compassionate, generous, whether it's fear of crime, fear of poverty, or maybe even fear of terrorism.
I remember after 9/11, this notion of what we were going to do. And when I talked to people, I talked to them about women as a group, and that from the time you find out you're female, you're taught if your family loves you, that they are members of your own species that will are dangerous to you. But that same family teaches you that they still expect you to go for broke and become who you can be, even though in your same species you're in a predator situation. And so I do think fear is a great force that can often paralyze you, but we really have examples of people who are threatened on every hand and absolutely refuse to allow that fear to keep them small or reducing the space in which they have to work. There's a man named Lucius Holloway who, after they said black people could vote, in Dawson, Georgia, they still had black people voting in the basement and upstairs. And he was 28, he walked upstairs. And there were 12 people in the room. He went over, he voted, and when he got ready to go out of the door, there were 4 people with bats that they were hitting on the floor. He flitted in one direction. They went after him, and somehow he got through the hole. And he said he ran as fast as he could, fell on his bed, had a heart attack. He was telling this story, and he's 80, and he's an official, an elected official of Dawson, Georgia. That's what you're supposed to do with fear. Fear tells you how dangerous it is, but it does not have to tell you that you're going to be paralyzed.
That's a great answer. Ms.
Judith suggested I'm going to ask a question about taxes, which actually is not totally unrelated to the cults, but that's another issue.
I mean, there has been, as the audience well knows, there has been a lot of newspaper ink devoted to the issue of property taxes the last 5 months in Marion County. And so my quick question is, what is our attitude about giving our personal money to the government to spend as public money? What does that say about our generosity?
Well, you've heard me say that I believe there's certain core services our government must be held accountable for providing. And I don't know the specifics of the tax situation here, and I can't assess exactly how the government is doing at providing. But I do know that whether it's the mayor or the state's work to try to improve education in the state, there's a long way to go. There's other kinds of services that need to be improved. And I'm sure that you'd all like to demand more efficiency for the dollars that are being spent, and we should be demanding more efficiency for the dollars they already have. But there are certain responsibilities to this community that's what our tax dollars are about. And if we're earning revenue or holding assets, it's part of our responsibility as citizens to underwrite government's provision of services. So I am not pro whatever tax increase is coming. I just believe that given whether it's European tax rates or tax rates anywhere else, that the important part is demanding and getting, demanding a certain quality of service from our government and getting a return on the dollars that they're spending. I don't necessarily believe that that we should end up with tax levels that disincent generosity. I think, that the current system is a great one where our taxes are not so high that we don't have resources to give. I think the idea that we need to be an even more giving society is one that we want to preserve, and that most of the laws that are on the books that encourage philanthropy are good ones. So it's a balance, I think, between the government's responsibility and our responsibility as individual citizens. But there's a baseline that this government, local, state, national, needs to afford all of us.
And I think, Susan, my wife and I, we live a half a mile from the bridge that fell in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And so when we were home the day that the bridge fell, and the lights flickered, and then just chaos ensued. And the public officials, right after that, when the cameras were rolling, of course, came out and said, we're going to take care of this. We'll have a gas tax increase. And what they failed to do is follow through. And so when it was convenient, they said, yeah, we'll do it. And then the cameras went away and the attention went away. And then they basically said, no, we're not going to do that. And so there was an opportunity to lead and address that. And you need to understand the context of this in Minnesota. The infrastructure there has been woefully underfunded for about a decade, right? And but the curious thing was, they did surveys around the state, and the people said, we don't really need to do a gas tax. And I just thought, wow, what will it take for us to make a little bit of a sacrifice to invest in that public good, that infrastructure? And these are roads, right? I mean, this isn't, something as crazy as healthcare. I mean, these are roads. And again, I was really a bit taken back by that. But then, as I, preparing to come to this festival and travel around the country a lot, and I told people, how excited I was to come and do this, and everyone was very curious about this Spirit in Place festival. Even in Minnesota, where we're a pretty particularly generous, community and state, they were really curious about this opportunity to bring these people together and to launch into this great 3-week conversation. So I want to say thank you all for continuing to support this because it's just a fantastic thing. And I'm trying to convince them to franchise it around the country so we can inspire others.
Great idea.
Spirit in Place is a great institution, an institution that Indianapolis and Central Indiana and the whole state should be proud of and grateful for. And I know that you've been inspired to hear from these three people who are leading such useful and generous lives. Please join me in thanking our public questioners and our conversation. And now, for just a closing word, Pam Blevins Henkel.
And Scott, thank you very much. Just a quick reminder to please let us know what you think and fill out those evaluation forms. It helps to improve both Spirit in Place and the public conversation. And while these forms provide a very valuable measure, we know that the ultimate success of Spirit in Place is best measured by what it provokes in you. It's you who will bring the words spoken on this stage today to life. We hope what you heard this afternoon will move you to continue the dialogue and to act in ways that will help transform your community, your congregation, your organization, or your business. As you leave this place, remember the power of genuine conversation, and remember that the possibility of our community resides in your action. Good afternoon.